and welcome to Dialect. Hello to our listeners in Bristol and also on Preston FM 103.2 up in the north and Radio Verulam in St Albans, and also to our listeners on Swindon FM. Yes, coming up in the programme, Dialect's Anthea Page visits the Shankhill Road in Belfast.
A couple of people came down from Ardoyne. They stopped the car, had white coats on as if they were delivering fish. They went and left a bomb on the counter. It exploded prematurely.
Ben Davies, he's here in the studio for part two of an interview about free legal aid. I also talked to Michael Lloyd-Jones about the proposed Bristol Pound that's coming up in May. We have a group of actors here in the studio from the St Paul's Eastern area of Bristol, and they're going to be chatting to me, and we're also going to be hearing a little bit of play and improvisation from them. Malcolm Greaves reads part two of the last chapter of Treasure Island. This is it, folks. It's the very last episode. Jeff Sparks is in the studio and he's got a What's On guide as per usual. Tim Burrows will be joining us later on with some music. I'm John Peters Coleman. It's my pleasure to introduce Ben Davies to the studio. Hello.
Hi there.
We've had you on previously. You are a legal student. You're coming to the end of your legal studies. You've done 3 years, I understand, your LLB.
Yep, that's
right. And you're now training to become a barrister.
Yep.
We chatted a lot about legal aid because the Conservatives are putting in cuts, surprise, surprise, and you were quite worried about what this says about what is going on in legal aid. So tell me a little bit about what your concerns are, just to sort of recap, you know, what you perceive the problems to be.
Absolutely. My paramount concern is that, quite simply, if we cut legal aid, the poor people will not be able to afford justice, and this creates an incredibly worrying situation. This is already a problem in America, where if you can't afford an attorney, you will have a substandard attorney appointed to you, somebody who's either completely green, has no experience, or has been reprimanded several times.
Okay, so potentially, if you became a barrister, you know, your first day on the job, that could even be you.
Absolutely. In theory, yes. There are instances where underqualified state attorneys are being appointed to defend people in America. In this country, on the other hand, if you have a very simple problem, if you've been charged with a very simple offence, then you will get an appropriately experienced solicitor or barrister.
I see.
If you've, however, been charged with a very serious offence, then you will be given an experienced barrister.
Mm-hmm. And the legal aid is basically what enables the system to match the right barrister to the right person.
Absolutely.
At the right time. So
absolutely.
Presumably that hopefully will therefore not happen to you. But if were you in America, that could possibly happen, but hopefully not here.
Absolutely. It's all down to the responsible allocation of funds. As I said last time I was on your programme, the legal aid barristers and solicitors owe a duty to the LSC. They have a duty to be independent and to act in the best interest of justice, and they must make a judgment call on whether or not a case warrants public money being spent on it.
So what evidence do we have that perhaps as the cuts are starting to impinge on legal aid, that perhaps people are not being allocated to the appropriate jobs?
Absolutely. We have problems with rejections of claims. Barristers are finding their claims being outright rejected because a stamp is in the wrong place, ultimately costing the claimants huge amounts. Payments are also being made late. Recently, barristers were expected to work up to 14 days in arrears. That is something that you can live with.
Okay, so that's an interesting point. Just to rewind. So what happens is that the barrister will get allocated to it, and then he asks for his fee essentially to be paid for by legal aid.
Yes.
And if they then say no, he then has to charge his...
Yes, absolutely. Right. If they say no, then there are alternatives that can be worked out. But specifically with regards to the lateness of the payments, the LSC now want to work up to 8 weeks in arrears. And I think asking anybody to work for 2 months without being paid is quite a lot to ask.
Okay.
There are also problems with clawbacks as well. Barristers are finding more and more that a claim that's been approved is then being clawed back later, in some cases up to 10 years, taken straight out of their business account because the LSC then changed their mind. Getting payments approved towards the end of the financial year is also more and more difficult. It's actually known amongst practitioners as the March black hole. A lot of clerks in chambers will tell you that you need to get all of your submissions to the LSC submitted by around December, otherwise you simply won't be paid.
Nice. Okay. How is this impinging on ethics? I mean, are barristers slowly becoming, I don't know, maybe not quite so keen to represent some people if this is going to involve legal aid?
Absolutely. That's a very good point. Ultimately, if these cuts continue, we'll see more and more practitioners going into full private practice, and justice will simply become a luxury for the wealthy.
Okay. The law is so wide-ranging. This comes from people like attempting to make some sort of a claim because they've slipped on a pavement to something, you know, ultimately really seriously, like murder or rape or something like that. So, I mean, is that perhaps not just going to mean that maybe more trivial cases will go by the way, and if somebody's slipped over on a pavement, they're not going to be able to get their easy no-win, no-fee...
The funny thing claim. Is, in 1999, they prevented personal injury claims from being dealt with on legal aid. They then introduced the contingency fee, the no-win, no-fee arrangement. Once this was introduced, we saw a torrent of, in some cases, really stupid litigation go through. Now, the problem is, although personal injury litigation is very unpopular, for every silly, ridiculous claim out there, there's a very, very deserving claim out there. An 18-year-old who's, through someone else's negligence, has become quadriplegic, for example.
Right.
Under the legal aid system, this person would be able to be represented by an adequate barrister. However, under the no-win, no-fee system, they can still get this representation, but of course this is a system that is still being manipulated further by the LSC because the barristers currently charge what's known as a success fee. This is essentially an additional payment on top of each winning claim that compensates them for the failed claims. Now, ultimately, when deciding upon a legal aid case, the barristers and solicitors, they have to make a judgment call, as I said. But with a no-win, no-fee, they can just go for anything. Now, if we are going to get rid of no-win, no-fee and get rid of legal aid, where this leaves the legitimate claims, I have no idea. One alternative is, of course, pro bono organisations, such as the one I work with, with the Community Legal Advice and Representation Service. We operate from the University of the West of England. And we essentially give free legal advice to members of the community in a wide-ranging areas of law.
Right, okay. How many pro bono organisations do you think there are? And do you think there are enough to meet supply?
Again, this is part of the problem. There are quite a lot of pro bono organisations, but there is not any regulation as to pro bono. And this is something that the government needs to step in and sort out, especially if it's going to cut legal aid. This is going to place more emphasis and more pressure on the pro bono sector. And currently, anybody can set up as a pro bono lawyer, regardless of experience.
Right.
We need to regulate this and make sure that those people getting pro bono advice are getting advice from registered pro bono lawyers.
Well, that kind of hints towards something that occurred to me when you're talking about the LSC. Other institutions, for example, you know, like the press, have a voluntary code of conduct. Other bodies have like an ombudsman. I mean, is there a, you know, some sort of a panel that oversees all of this, which has some kind of a legal bite? Or is it a relatively voluntary code of conduct to apply to all of these things? And if somebody said, well, I don't like what you're doing, they could just carry on doing what they do.
Well, the Ministry of Justice regulates what the LSC does.
Right.
And everything essentially goes through the Ministry of Justice. The barrister's independent professional code of conduct also comes into this. Speaking as a trainee barrister, if I represent somebody on legal aid, I have this, as I say, this duty to make sure that the public money is being spent wisely and responsibly. Now, the code of conduct to which barristers are subject is probably one of the most stringent in the world. We have a very serious duty.
Plenty of bite, then.
Absolutely.
Plenty of bite.
Absolutely.
So it's just a case of trying to match that up with some of the extraneous sort of areas which have been perhaps overlooked, like pro bono, and they don't actually currently come under the Ministry of Justice aegis at the moment.
The practitioners in our organisation, the barristers who practice as part of our group voluntarily, they are naturally subject to the Barristers' Code of Conduct. Hmm. And this is something we would like to see in other pro bono organisations, by way of regulation, make sure that these organisations are executed properly and that the advice given is sound advice.
Okay. So if the Ministry of Justice has plenty of bite, then, you know, is there really a problem if legal aid budget is cut? I mean, presumably if there are sort of injustices or malpractices going on to try and stop various people getting legal aid because this is going to cost the taxpayer money, the Ministry of Justice will just be able to sort of step in and give somebody a slap on the back of the hand?
Absolutely. It's interesting that the Ministry of Justice do interfere with claims like this, there are ways of recovering and recycling public funds by way of statutory charge. So if somebody brings a claim to get possession of a house, for example, and this claim costs £20,000, the LSC can place a charge on that house of £20,000 so that when it's sold, the claimant essentially has to give that money back to the LSC. So there are lots of ways in which the public funds can be recovered.
Okay. So all hope is not totally lost then?
Absolutely not. And okay. I would, personally speaking, I would find the legal aid system far preferable to the no-win, no-fee system, because the no-win, no-fee system ultimately is designed to bring frivolous litigation.
Okay.
Whereas the legal aid system is naturally designed to have a sense of honour and integrity built into it.
So there's a lot of pressure going on at the moment upon legal aid. All hope is perhaps not completely lost, but if people are concerned, they should write to their MP?
Absolutely, write to their MPs, let them know that they want to keep the legal aid budget, which ultimately is responsible for England having the most advanced legal system in the world.
Okay.
On my course, for example, I would say 90% of the people training on the BPTC, which is where I'm training at the moment, are from foreign jurisdictions. They all come over here to learn from the English legal jurisdiction.
Okay, well, Ben Davies, on that bombshell, thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
Money makes the world go around, the world go around, the world go around. Money makes the world go around, it makes the world go round. A mark, a yen, a buck or a pound, a mark, a yen, a buck or a pound is all that makes the world go around, the clinking, clanking sound.
I'd like to introduce the studio, Michael Lloyd-Jones. Hello.
Hi there.
You're a representative of the Bristol Pound, or the organisation that is running it. In what capacity do you work with them?
We're a little bit loose on my role exactly. I think today it is trader relationship manager.
Okay.
But my role essentially is what we're calling business engagement. So now that we've designed the scheme and the Bristol Pound is scheduled to launch in May, my role is to meet with businesses, talk with them, and explain to them how the system works and basically get them on board with the scheme ready to launch in May.
Okay. So how many of you are there in an office somewhere working on this scheme?
Well, everybody who works for the Bristol Pound is working on a voluntary basis. So that's no salary, unfortunately.
Okay.
But we have probably a core team of about 14 people. So there's some people who lend a lot of their time. So the directors mainly.
Mm.
But we have other people who've lent us a helping hand with their skills. So we have a chap who works in PR, a chap who's given us help with social media. And one of our designers who's unfortunately left us, who designed the really, really, I think, excellent Bristol Pound logo and all of our branding. She actually was so good that she's now moved on to a full-time job, which is fantastic, obviously. Yeah. But yeah, I think of roughly about 14, but about five or six full.
Okay, so how long since, I mean, from the background of obviously thinking about the idea, I mean, how long has this scheme taken to really try and get stuff like on paper, black and white, and let's get things happening? How long has this been going on?
It's taken roughly 2 years. The directors, I think, all met. Kieran Mundy is one of the directors, and Chris Sunderland, they're two of the core people who kind of began the idea. And they went, I believe Kieran tells me a story, he went to a discussion group, essentially. It's called the Money and Economics Forum or something like that. And someone basically suggested, what if we had a local currency in Bristol?
And from such a fairly dry sounding forum, this like, concept has now actually come about.
Yes.
So is there a warehouse somewhere with all of this money in bundles?
There isn't just at the moment.
But there will be.
There will be, yes.
Oh, how exciting.
Yes. The Bristol Pounds, when they are launched, will be released out into the economy, as it were. So we have two forms of the Bristol Pound, essentially. You can spend it in cash, or have notes with denominations of 1, 5, 10 and 20, which will be specially designed by the people of Bristol. We're currently running a competition to design them, which closes on March the 14th. So it's getting quite close to the deadline.
Okay.
That will be judged at Colston Hall, which will be very exciting on the 15th. And the second way that you can pay for your Bristol Pounds, which really takes the scheme on and the next level after from previous local currency schemes across the UK, is we have an electronic payment system.
Okay. Now, how this all sounds, obviously, in people's minds, I can imagine thinking, well, compared to the Bank of England, this is beginning to sound, you know, this is amateur, essentially. So isn't this easy to break into with crime? You know, somebody could just hack in and make loads of money?
No. In short, no. As I said, it began 2 years ago and they've done a great deal of homework on how this can work. They've done a very large feasibility study and a great deal of consultation with a great number of people, including a lot of businesses across Bristol, to make sure that this will work. So security is obviously a primary concern. So the electronic system is essentially banking level software. in terms of security.
Sort of the same as would be used by Lloyd's NatWest.
Yeah, and the same thing. And the notes as well have just as many security features as you would expect from Sterling.
Do you have to get legal recognition of this?
No, from a legal perspective, it's essentially you can accept anything in exchange for goods or services. That's your choice. It's not what you call legal tender, as in the Bank of England won't accept it, but they can be banked with a Bristol Credit Union. From a legal perspective, it's essentially a book token.
Okay. Where do people actually get it, if that's an obvious question?
What you can do, if you want to get the cash, you can go to the Bristol Credit Union and cash in your cold hard cash over the counter and receive Bristol pounds. But if you really want to get spending and make the most of the scheme, you can sign up for an account, an electronic account. So you go to the Bristol Credit Union, you fill out their form, which is essentially the same as you would for a normal account, but you fill in your mobile phone number, you get a username and a PIN number, and then you receive a text from the Bristol Credit Union once your account is confirmed. And you receive a text, you save this number as Bristol Pound e-payments or whatever you want to do. Mm-hmm. And then when you go to a shop which is accepting the Bristol Pound, you say, I'd like to pay, here's your loaf of bread or whatever it is. And you say, that's £4.65, just number off the top of my head, or one, whatever you want to do. And then you say, right, and you write to text. And the formula is pay, PIN number, username. So if it was Joe's Bakery, who was one of the first traders to take part in the scheme, pay, PIN number, Joe's Bakery, and then the amount.
Okay, and what are the main advantages in brief? What is the point of, you know, why would you want to spend a Bristol Pound?
Essentially, if you think about when you spend your money with a national chain, where does that money go? That money, essentially, if you spend it with a large national chain, the money will most likely leave Bristol very quickly. It'll probably go to London and end up most of it in an offshore bank account. If you spend your money with a local business, that's money being invested in the community, essentially. That's a business that is situated in the community and spend money in the community. So if you have a local currency, that ensures that that business, once you spend money with them, will spend that money elsewhere. So imagine the number of hands that money goes through, and they're all based in Bristol.
Okay,
how that's far essentially out of, having more money in,
how far
in
out
the
of
city.
Bristol could this potentially spread? You know, what if businesses outside, you know, Yeovil or something, says they're interested?
Well, the rule of thumb is if you have a BS postcode, you can partake in the scheme, which is actually quite extensive. I actually had some contact today with someone from Jeddah who's very interested in the scheme, and they look like they'll be doing it. So, and there's actually a great deal of goods and services produced across the BS area. So a lot of food, a lot of UK's food is grown in Bristol, a lot of breweries, a lot of drinks, a lot of businesses exist in the southwest in this BS area. So there's a great deal of diversity.
Okay, so how long is it going to be until the Exchequer cottons onto this and slaps a tax on you or tries to...
Well, from a tax perspective, it works the same as sterling, because each Bristol pound is guaranteed by a physical sterling, a sterling that's held at the Bristol Credit Union.
Yeah.
So essentially subbing out a sterling for a Bristol pound. And that Bristol pound can only be spent within the Bristol economy.
In terms of tax, see, the government probably isn't really going to mind too much either way.
No, we've actually had a message from the FSA today who wants to review the Bristol pound to make sure everything's above board. We're obviously working with the Bristol Credit Union, who are a fully FSA regulated financial body. And they've been very keen to make sure the fine details are precise and everything's above board. And as far as you know, up to this point, it is.
Okay. If people are a little bit, like, not particularly tech-savvy, and just thinking back about this sort of mobile phone payment thing, and this will be new to some people, do you have to have sort of 3G, or how does it work? Take me by that again.
All you need to do is send a text payment. So you write a text, which is pay, PIN number, username, and then the amount.
Literally as simple as that.
You send that, and it takes about 4 to 5 seconds. The recipient receives a text message confirming it, and you receive a text saying it's
gone. So while you're stood there at the till, he gets his text and receipt, and then you paid him, that's it.
Mm-hmm. It's cheaper than PDQ payments, and the payment is instant as well. It doesn't take 3 to 4 days.
Where are you online if people want to find out more?
If you go to bristolpound.org, you can find all our details there. And if you want to enter the design competition, there's a tab at the top. So get your entries in by March the 14th.
Yeah, so be quick, because the deadline is coming. Michael Lord-Jones, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Last Saturday, a 31-year-old man was shot in Belfast city centre. The police said no paramilitary were involved in the murder. Our reporter Anthea Page was in Belfast last Saturday, and she went on a visit to the Shankill Road and Falls area of the city, the scene of violence for 30 years, to see how life has moved on since those days of the Troubles. For security reasons, we are not naming the local man who acted as a guide to the visit, which was carried out in a car, and this is part one of the feature.
Peters Hill, a bit of a source of trouble in the early days. Unity Flats on the right were largely Catholic, and Orange Parades would come down the Shankill Road here, Shankill Road, Peters Hill, into city centre, and this often caused conflict passing Unity Flats, where allegedly many of the folks who lived there threw things from the height of the flats at those who were parading past. This lower part of the Shankill Road here is infamous for Johnny Adair. He was C Company of the UDA. He ran this bit of the Shankill here in those early days.
There's a lot of new development. Why is that? Why is there so many empty wasteland?
Well, because there was really old housing here. It's been redeveloped over the years. Some of the new housing has also been redeveloped because there were what are commonly called masonettes. People didn't like living in them, so they pulled them down and they've built houses now. A lot of people moved out from the lower Shankill area to what's called Glencairn, the upper part of the Shankill. We're passing on the left Shankill Leisure Centre. There was, on this site many years ago, the Balmore Furnishing Company, and there was a bomb planted there by the IRA, which killed a number of people, including a child in a pram. That led a lot of people in the Shankill, therefore, to join paramilitary organisations.
So when did the troubles start along here? What date are we talking about?
1969. Really, we're talking of intercommunal conflict. As we drive up the Shankill Road, the Catholic Falls would be to the left, and the streets down here, there was quite a lot of conflict.
What sparked it off mainly?
You could write a series of books on that. Most of the conflict started here as a result of the problems in Londonderry. Intercommunal conflict started, and then the army were brought in to separate people. The conflict started because the police were being beaten in Londonderry, and folks here felt, right, we've got to protect our community. There's this whole concept here of our community on both sides. We're now crossing into another part of the Shankill north of Northumberland Street, which would be UVF controlled, whereas the lower bit would have been UDA controlled, C Company. Innocent people died there in a bomb that was thrown into a bar called the Bernardo.
What did those initials stand for?
UVF, the Ulster Volunteer Force, Protestant paramilitary organisation. It was modelled on an older UVF, which was established to oppose Home Rule and became part of what was the 36th Ulster Division in the British Army in the First World War. We're stopped here at this as a memorial over here to a couple of UVF men who were shot here in more recent days of the Troubles, towards the end of the Troubles. Again, over here you see the famous Rex Bar on my right. The Rex Bar is a famous UVF bar. And again here, when there's some UDA-UVF interfighting, people met their end around these parts. There's a plaque up there on this bookmakers here, no doubt to some others who met a very swift end.
It says the People's Army, and there's the whole shop window's taken up with the Union Jack.
Well, it's not a shop window, it's just a wall painted over. There are no windows in bookmaker shops because there's too much money in them.
On the left, where I'm looking out the car window, there's a big banner up there which says Families Against Supergrass Trials Demand Human Rights and Justice.
In the past, there were what were called supergrass trials, where people who were members of paramilitary organisations were persuaded to turn state's evidence against their comrades. They were called supergrass trials. Now, those actually came to a very quick end because, for a number of reasons, the judges wouldn't accept a lot of the evidence, etc. But in more recent days, there's been legislation to bring in what is alleged to be supergrass, but it's not effectively a supergrass. It's someone who's prepared to turn state's evidence, and they still get sentenced, but they, like America, they have a lesser sentence. It's not really the same as the old supergrasses, but it's very convenient for people to call them supergrass because that has all sorts of political connotations.
You get the real sense of history sitting here, places where people have been killed, where bombs have gone off, where people have been shot. It's quite shocking, isn't it?
Yes, and there have been many funerals. over the years. Some people have been murdered or been innocent. That is, they were not involved in any political activity, paramilitary or otherwise. But there are others, of course, who met their end simply because they were involved in paramilitary organisations and activities.
But how easy was it to get embroiled in the IRA because of fear of what might happen to your family if you didn't?
Well, it was very easy to get involved either in the IRA or in the loyalist paramilitary organisations, because there was this kind of pressure to support your community and stand by your community and support your area and protect your area. So that was the whole motivation. But again, like a lot of these intercommunal things, a lot of it's based on rumour and various innuendos.
Was it a bit like drug gangs? Once you were in, you couldn't get out of it?
A bit like that, yes. We're now passing a memorial garden on the left here. This is a memorial garden. It was developed after the Shankill bomb, which came towards the end of the Troubles. A bomb was placed in that building just across the road there, which is now the Court Credit Union building. There was a fish shop there called Frizzell's. A couple of people came down from Ardoyne. They stopped the car, had white coats on as if they were delivering fish. They went and left a bomb on the counter. It exploded prematurely. The driver of the car got away. The whole building collapsed. The reason why it was put into the fish shop was because there were rooms above it which were apparently used by members of a paramilitary organisation for meeting. But of course, at that particular time, they weren't meeting there. So they were murdered in what's commonly now called the Shankill bomb. And then there was retaliation after that, of course. It's all the tit-for-tat stuff. The retaliation after that was Greysteel, when people went into a public house in the north coast of Northern Ireland on Halloween evening and murdered a number of people. And then this Frizzell's apparently was retaliation for another loyalist murder down in a place called Lochan Island in County Down, where people were meeting to watch a football match, and they were murdered. So it was all tit for tat stuff.
Yeah. So when did it calm down, the Shankill Road?
Well, it's questionable whether it's even calmed down now, because I mean, what Gerry Adams said about the IRA some years ago, they haven't gone away, you know, I think could apply equally now to loyalist paramilitaries who have not gone away, you know. They're still involved in racketeering, drugs, etc.
Thank you, Anthea, for that report on Belfast, and you can hear part two of that next week. Well, I'd like to welcome to the studio Jess, Lekayla and Amari, and they're all from Dream Chase Theatre. Hello.
Hello.
Rick.
So, Jess, you're in the middle, so I'm going to pick on you first. Tell me, who are Dream Chase Theatre?
We're a young theatre company, and we're based in the Mill Youth Centre in Easton. We've been together now since about September, where we work on theatre and education, and me and Kayla wrote the piece ourselves, through some of it through our own imagination and some of it through devising within the workshop.
Okay.
And we create pieces to take around schools and eventually to make into short films as well.
Okay, so Amara, did you all meet together at the theatre, or did you know each other from school before? Or
I've known Kayla, and then she's introduced me to Jess, and then through like us meeting up and everyone being like as serious as each other and on the same page, you kind of developed a friendship and took it forever from there.
Okay, so Lekayla, what do you ever have that interest in acting before this?
Yeah, definitely. I used to go to Stagecoach Theatre Company when I was like nine. I went there for like 5 years, and I've just always had a passion for acting and singing and dancing, like musical theatre and stuff.
Yeah.
And like theatre stuff.
So, how did you organise getting yourself together, and how many of you are there?
Well, all together, there's about between eight and ten of us, but Amari does a lot of filmmaking, and him and Kayla knew each other through doing filmmaking and music. I knew Kayla personally because we did dance together and we've done acting together in the past. So we kind of got together and formed a kind of group. We decided we wanted to get other people involved and take it from there, really.
Okay, so have you put anything on yet?
No, we've not. We're currently like working on our first piece at the moment, which hopefully will be ready. It should have been ready by about Easter time, but we've been had to postpone it because of like cast members and so on. So it should be ready about by May time, when we hope to take it around schools and also hire out a theatre for about 2 or 3 nights and put it on then.
Okay, so Amari, have you ever acted in public before? What sort of acting?
Yeah, I've done I started off at 14 doing a little bit of pieces going around with school with the gang awareness project.
Yeah.
And then I went on to working with BBC and Aardman Animation, and then doing my own stuff after that.
Okay. How about yourself, Michaela?
Yeah, I've done a lot of work in Stagecoach, and then I've always been leads in my school plays. And then we did this performance called Children of Killers. This was last year, March. And we took it to Bristol Old Vic, and we performed it 7 nights in a row. And then we won the competition, and we performed at the National Theatre in London.
Amazing. So what sort of themes are you working in on your new piece that you're writing, Jess?
The current one is mainly based, it's set in a school, and it's Sex Education Week. So we're kind of looking at all of the issues that come up within underage sex, and it's aimed at teenagers, 16-year-olds, and none of us really had sex education, and the sort of stuff it looks at the myths and the rumours and the truths, STIs and pregnancies, chlamydia, the sort of rumours and peer pressure and the sort of things that children experience as they're growing up.
So basically we want to educate and entertain at the same time.
Okay, so yeah.
You entertain them and give them a message at the same time, and you let them learn as they're being entertained.
Because it's quite funny, but it's got serious elements to it as well. So it's hopefully there's a character that everybody should be able to relate to, but at the same time it's funny and it's a bit lighthearted.
Okay, and you've brought us a couple of sketches on stand that you're
yeah,
called for
we've
us
got,
tonight.
Yeah, we've got one which is between two of the pupils, which are kind of the cheeky boys, and one which is, it shows a bit of the educational side of it when one of the guys finds out he's got chlamydia from a girl.
Okay, and what are the two other people's names who are involved?
Sean and Chris.
Okay, so we haven't interviewed them, but we'll be hearing them in the sketch in a bit. Okay, thank you.
Lovely. Thank you.
Thank you. Yo, Kojo. Can we come around your house on the weekend?
My parents are away, so I've got a free yard, so we can get to my house on Friday, but what are we going to do?
Have a little party, innit?
A party?
Yeah, man.
So who's going to be there?
All the girls from our class.
Just our class? Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah.
So we're going to sit down, we're going to watch TV, popcorn?
Nah, man. We're going to get drunk.
No. No drinking in my house, sorry. You can have squash, you can have apple juice.
What do you mean?
Fantas. Please, you have to respect my rules. If you are coming to my house, then you cannot have any sort of alcohol in my house. No alcohol, no weeds. And the lights must remain on at all times.
So, can we not go up to your room?
My room? For what?
To have, you know...
Why would you want to play games in my room when you can play in the front room?
Not games, you know what I mean, man.
Come on, you cannot be putting those condoms in my house.
I hide them underneath your pillow.
Hey, you want me to sleep with condoms? No, I can't do that one.
Why?
No.
Please.
You're going to spill it on my pillows.
Nah, I'll make sure I clean up.
No.
I'm tidy.
Not this time, maybe next time in your house, but not my house. My house, no sex. No alcohol or no illegal substances in my house. We are underage.
Fine, man.
What, Nathan? Nathan, what do you want?
What's this I hear about you got chlamydia?
What about it?
Is it true?
And what if it is true?
Well, does that mean I have it?
Oh, I don't know.
Well, who did you get it from?
I don't know. 76,436 people aged between 14 and 25 were diagnosed with it last year in Bristol alone. Remember the statistics? That's a lot of people it could have come from.
Oh, you must know how long you had it.
Oh, I don't know.
How can you not know?
There's no symptoms most of the time, idiot.
So do you think you got it before or after you slept with me?
I've got no idea, Nathan.
Well, who did you sleep with before? And who did you sleep with after?
I don't know who gave it to me.
Does it smell?
You should know.
I heard it can make you not able to have kids.
Yeah, well, if you don't treat it for 3 years or you keep getting it over and over again, then it can make you infertile. That's why you need to get it sorted.
So what? You could have made me not able to have children. Do you want me to stop having babies?
Just get it sorted and make sure you don't get it again.
Me make sure? It's your fault. You've given it to me.
Well, you should have had a condom.
I did.
So why didn't you use it?
I was caught up in the moment.
So there we go.
Well, you weren't saying no.
And I'm not the one complaining now.
It's a girl's responsibility, not mine.
Oh, whatever. That's crap. Are we done now?
Wait, how do I get rid of it?
Go and get the tablet. It's just one dose, and you can't have sex for a week, but then it's gone.
Where do I get a test and the treatment?
Oh, I don't know. Your doctors, NHS walk-in centre. It's in town. You can go to Five Points. It's right by up there from there. Or you can go to Brook in town. It's a sexual health clinic. You should know these things.
How do you know so much?
Oh, do I look like an information leaflet? Stop asking me all these questions. Nathan, what do you want?
What?
What?
If I've got it, I'm gonna...
You're gonna what?
I'm gonna get rid of it.
Good.
And so now indeed, a historic moment. I have my black armband on and I have taken my flat cap off. This is the very, very last instalment of Treasure Island, written by Robert Louis Stevenson and read by Malcolm Grieve. This is Chapter 34, Part 2.
That was about our last doing on the island. Before that, we had got the treasure stowed and had shipped enough water and the remainder of the goat meat in case of any distress. And at last, one fine morning, we weighed anchor, which was about all that we could manage, and stood out of North Inlet, the same colours flying that the captain had flown and fought under at the palisade. Three fellows must have been watching us closer than we thought for, as we soon had proved. For, coming through the narrows, we had to lie very near the southern point, and then we saw all three of them kneeling together on a spit of sand, with their arms raised in supplication. It went all to our hearts, I think, to leave them in that wretched state. But we could not risk another mutiny, and to take them home for the gibbet would have seemed a cruel sort of kindness. The doctor hailed them, and told them of the stores we had left, and where they were to find them. But they continued to call us by name, and appeal to us, for God's sake, to be merciful, and not to leave them to die in such a place. At last, seeing the ship still bore upon her course and was now drawing swiftly out of earshot, one of them, I know not which it was, leapt to his feet, and with a hoarse cry whipped his musket to his shoulder, and sent a shot whistling over Silver's head, and through the mainsail. After that, we kept under cover of the bulwarks. And when next I looked out, they had disappeared from the spit, and the spit itself had almost melted out of sight in a growing distance. That was, at least, the end of that, and before noon, to my inexpressible joy, the highest rock of Treasure Island had sunk into the blue round of the sea. We were so short of men that everyone on board had to bear a hand, only the captain lying on a mattress in the stern and giving his orders, for though greatly recovered, he was still in want of quiet. We laid her head for the nearest port in Spanish America, for we could not risk the voyage home without fresh hands, and as it was, what with baffling winds and a couple of fresh gales, we were all worn out before we reached it. It was just at sundown when we cast anchor in a most beautiful and landlocked gulf, and were immediately surrounded by shore boats full of Negroes and Mexican Indians and half-bloods selling fruits and vegetables and offering to dive for bits of money. The sight of so many good-humoured faces, especially the blacks, the taste of the tropical fruits, and above all, the lights that began to shine in the town, made a most charming contrast to our dark and bloody sojourn on the island, and the doctor and the squire, taking me along with them, went ashore to pass the early part of the night. Here they met the captain of an English man of war, fell in talk with him, went on board his ship, and in short had so agreeable a time that day was breaking when we came alongside the Hispaniola. Ben Gunn was on deck alone, and as soon as we came on board he began with wonderful contortions to make us a confession. Silver was gone. The Maroon had connived in his escape in a shore boat some hours ago, and he now assured us that he had only done so to preserve our lives, which would certainly have been forfeit if that man with the one leg had stayed aboard. But this was not all. The sea cook had not gone empty-handed. He had cut through a bulkhead unobserved and had removed one of the sacks of coin worth perhaps 300 or 400 guineas to help him on his further wanderings. I think we were all pleased to be so cheaply quit of him. Well, to make a long story short, we got a few hands on board, made a good cruise home, and the Hispaniola reached Bristol just as Mr. Blandy was beginning to think of fitting out her consort. 5 men only of those who sailed returned with her. Drink and the devil had done for the rest, with a vengeance. Although, to be sure, we were not in quite so bad a case as that other ship they sang about. With 1 man of her crew alive, what put to sea with 75... All of us had an ample share of the treasure, and used it wisely or foolishly according to their natures. Captain Smollett is now retired from the sea. Grey not only saved his money, but being suddenly smit with the desire to rise, also studied his profession, and he is now mate and part owner of a fine, full-rigged ship, married besides, and the father of a family. As for Ben Gunn, he got £1,000. Which he spent or lost in 3 weeks, or to be more exact, in 19 days, for he was back begging on the 20th. Then he was given a lodge to keep, exactly as he had feared upon the island, and he still lives, a great favourite, or something of a butt, with the country boys, and a notable singer in church on Sundays and saints' days. Of Silver we have heard no more. That formidable seafaring man with one leg has at last gone clean out of my life. But I dare say he met his old negress, and perhaps still lives in comfort with her and Captain Flint. It is to be hoped so, I suppose, for his chances of comfort in another world are small. The bar Silver and the arms still lie, for all that I know, where Flint buried them, and certainly they shall lie there for me. Oxen and wain ropes would not bring me back again to that accursed island. And the worst dreams that I ever have are when I hear the surf booming about its coasts. Or start upright in bed with the sharp voice of Captain Flint ringing in my ears. Pieces of eight. Pieces of eight.
That was part 2, chapter 34 of Treasure Island, written by Robert Louis Stevenson and read by Malcolm Grieve. We've decided to give him a little bit of time off, but next week Malcolm Grieve, I believe, is reading a one-off instalment of something written by Lady Stanhope from a long time ago about her travels in Syria in the 18th century. And then after that, we will be starting a new book to serialise, more about that in the coming weeks. It's my pleasure now, for a bit of a taste of music, to introduce Tim Burrows. Hello.
Hi.
Branching out from poetry and introducing your guitar, which you've had in recent weeks, what's your theme for today?
Well, Jen, I wrote this song, is called Songlines for the Dreamtime. I wrote this in Alice Springs in Australia, and it brings in a bit about the songlines of the ancestors of the Aborigine people. And I'd like to dedicate it to the Aborigine people and to Bruce Chatwin, who I read a book called The Songlines, which covers a lot of the same stuff. And in the song, it brings in the fact that Aborigines all have an ancestor. Men and women have different ancestors, and they all charted the progress, and the world was brought into being by them walking across different parts of Australia. So those are the song lines. And it also, the song also brings in the idea that maybe the world was silent at one stage and the first words were in song, like birds rather than spoken.
Yeah.
So I hope you like it. And
okay, let's hear it.
Again, I hit the road to find the world anew, to find some words to fit my life, and maybe find love too. For movement is the pulse of verse, rhythm of the song, the murmur of the whispering tongue that fills the milestone. To sing the world into being, to join the ancestor song, to map their progress across the land, unite tribes. Beginning there was the word, the I am of man, the words that broke the silence and filled the world with song. This movement is the pulse of verse, the rhythm of the song, the murmur of fellow's not going walk about. He's following his ancestors' path. He's checking his link in the chain to make the dream time live again. 'Cause movement is the pulse of verse, the rhythm of the song, the murmur of the whisper.
Very much, Tim Burrows, and hopefully you'll be coming back. Have you got any more songs lined up in the coming weeks?
Yeah, I'm always writing songs, always beaming away. Always, yeah.
And so if you like the theme of that song, you mentioned Songlines, there is of course always Songlines magazine featuring lots of world music. So there you go, Tim Burrows. Thank you.
Thanks.
It's time now to introduce Jess Sparks in his Judas Priest t-shirts for the What's On Guide for this week.
Thank you, John. Hello, this is a What's On Guide from Dialect. Starting with Friday, 16th of March, Rise to Remain will be performing with support from Heaven Shall Born, Malefis and Cytota at the Fleece in St. Thomas Street, Bristol. Tickets are £10 in advance and doors open at 7:30pm. Keeping with 16th of March, mod covers band The Suspicions will be performing at Victoria in Victoria Road, Swindon. Entry is free and doors open at 8pm. Also on 16th of March, The Answer will be performing with support from The Union and also Scam at the O2 Academy in Frogmore Street, Bristol. Tickets are £15 in advance and doors open at 6:30pm. On to Song of the Week, and I present Dropkick Murphys. This Celtic punk group formed in Quincy, Massachusetts, USA in 1996, and in their career they have released 7 studio albums and 2 live albums. This is from the Live on St. Patrick's Day album, released in 2002, and it's the track Wild Rover. That was Dropkick Murphys with Wild Rover from the album Live on St. Patrick's Day, which was released in 2002. Into Saturday, 17th of March, Thump presents Tinty Strider with support from DOD at 53 Degrees in Brook Street, Preston. Tickets are £12 in advance and doors open at 10pm. Also on 17th of March, The Stranglers will be performing with support from The Popes at O2 Academy in Frogmore Street, Bristol. Tickets are £23 in advance and doors open at 7pm. Finally, on Sunday, 18th of March, Exhumed will be performing with support from Arnav Nathrak, Merciless Precision and Separation at the Free in St. Thomas Street, Bristol. Tickets are £15 in advance and doors open at 7:30 p.m. That's all from me. Thanks for listening and have a good week. Take care and goodbye.
And returning to the sulphurous caverns from whence he came, goodbye to Jess Box. Before we finish the show, a mention now about the Titanic Belfast Festival. It's opening with a unique tea party on the 31st of March, followed by a whole host of events to commemorate a range of significant anniversaries connected to the Titanic. These include the birth of the ship, 31st of March 1909, the 100th anniversary of the ship leaving Belfast in 1912, and the 100th anniversary, of course, of the sinking of the said ship on the 15th of April. The two-week festival is being held to mark the opening of the multi-million pound Titanic Visitor Centre in the newly developed Titanic Quarter. If you want to find out more, you can go to www.titanicbelfast.com. That's all from Dialect this week. We had various studio guests, Ben Davies, Michael Lloyd-Jones, the Dream Chase Theatre, some of their cast members. We'll find out more about those online in the coming weeks and months, I'm sure. We also had Malcolm Grieve reading Treasure Island, and we had Tim Burrows doing music. What's on Guide was by Jeff Sparks, and it was engineered by Michael Noyce, and the producer was Anthea Page. And not forgetting me, of course, I'm John Peters Colwyn. So thank you very much for listening. If you are, I assume you are. Until next week, goodbye.
got